Okay, so here we go, ready? So again, we are doing Tehillim Kufmembe'ez. The reason that I picked that is because it's one of the Prakim that has a very obvious historical context, and is one of the ones that we say all the time. So I feel like I could do sort of like we could decide that we want to pick random Tehillims from anywhere and study them, which is totally fine. We could decide we want to do that, or we could learn together the ones that are very common, the ones that are very ubiquitous that we say all the time, and try to get sort of like a deeper grasp of it. So that's what I was going for. Again, feedback you'll send my way, I hope, after this, about how you stack up, your opinion on that. Cheshbon. Okay, ready? Kuf Mem Beis. So this is what we're gonna do. We're gonna read the first pasuk inside, which is gonna throw us off. Then we're gonna talk about Tanakh, like the Tanakh basis of it, and then we're gonna go back and read the rest of Kuf Mem Beis. Okay? Again, everyone here, Kuf Mem Beis is one of the ones that you're familiar with, or was that just my Beis Yaakov school who did that, or does everyone's school do that? Kuf Mem Beis? Yes. Can I get nods or hands up if this is one of the ones that you did? No? Really?
Yes.
Fascinating. Yes? No? I got some no's and I got some yeses. Fascinating. This was an assumption that I made without checking it. Okay. This is a maskil from David. Again, what does that mean? Different introductions, a different kind of prakim of Tehillim. When he was in the cave, a tefillah, a prayer. Okay, so the first thing that we have to do, again, we could continue reading the Tehillim, but David is very specifically pointing to a certain point in his life. Before he even starts telling us what the Perek of Tehillim is about, he tells us where he is in his life when this happens. Not all Perek of Tehillim do this. Some of them do, some of them don't. I don't know the exact percentage breakdown. But when we get that kind of marker, the best thing to do before we learn it is to understand where David was. He's telling you where he was so that you understand from the vantage point at which he was saying this Perek of Tehillim. So let's go to that vantage point and understand again what is happening in David's life that he is now going to say Perek Kuf Mem Beis, that again is at least in my background one of the ones that is repeated again and again and again and again and again by us in these many of thousands of years after David HaMelech lived. Okay, so everybody have a Tanakh or a Sefer Tehillim in front of them in some capacity. I hope so. If not, you Sima sent those like really super useful links to the group, which was like very helpful. Feel free to pull those up. We're going to be doing a little bit more inside here than we did in Sichos Moser. But I'm not really going to do it inside. I'm going to do it outside. But again, it's probably going to make more sense or just be more interesting or engaging if you have it in front of you as well, both the Tehillim and the Tanakh. Okay, so first,
Sorry, Anna.
yes, go ahead. Hi, Yasmin.
What period is it again? I just want to find it in front of me.
Awesome, good. Shmuel Aleph, Parak Chaf Dalad.
Thank you.
Okay, good question. Thank you, Shmuel Aleph Perek Chaf Dalet. Okay, before we even do this, this is a specific, again, this Perek is a specific happening in David's life that was basically a life-changing event for him. He wrote two Prekem of Tehillim on it. One is Nun Zayin, and one of this is this one, Kuf Mem Beis. Before this, we have to know the historical context that led up to this, right? You can't like say that you're going to learn something in context and then just pull up like a random Perek and then just read that Perek, right? You have to actually know what's going on. So let's talk a tiny bit about just like the general history of David HaMelech, which we'll do quickly and hopefully only this time. And we won't have to do it again in the future as we pick out points in his life that were significant that he writes Perekim of Tehillim about those or like from that vantage point. Good. So B'nai Israel asked for a king in the time of Shmuel, which was right after the Shoftim. Shmuel follows Eli. Eli follows the Shoftim. So it's Yehoshua and then Shoftim and then Eli and then Shmuel. Okay. In the time of Shmuel, B'nai Israel ask for a king. They want a king. There's a whole debate that I'm wondering out with one of my chavrusas about the mitzvah, whether or not it's a mitzvah or not, whatever, to appoint a king. But anyway, Shmuel's kind of upset about this, but he anyways anoints a king. And who's the first king that he anoints over Bnei Yisrael? Is it David? No. Who is it? Shaul, right? Good. Shalom. I'm gonna close the participants. If anyone sees that somebody's waiting or something or someone texts them, let me know, okay? Because it's annoying me, this little box over here. Okay. So he anoints Shaul, okay? As we have learned in Sichos Moser mentioned this several times, Shaul lost the right to Melucha by not listening to Shmuel slash Hashem two times, right? Shmuel tells him, wait for me before you bring a carbon and start this war. And he's like all antsy and everyone starts like pestering him to start the war, Shaul. And Shaul starts, he brings the carbon himself, starts the war. Shmuel comes afterwards and is like, I told you to wait for me. And Shaul's like, I'm really sorry that the nation was like pressuring me. All right, and the second time, Shmuel tells Shaul, kill all of Amalek, all of Amalek, kill all of Amalek. And Shaul doesn't. Again, seeming to be with the best intention, he leaves Agag alive and he leaves the best of the cattle alive to bring his karbanos. And again, Shmuel is extremely upset and tells him, I'm sorry you lost the melucha. Okay, that sort of like closes that story. And for the rest of his life, Shmuel did not see Shaul because he was so upset. It says that Shmuel mourned over Shaul. The rest of his life, he was like really upset at the loss of potential. Meanwhile, right after that, Hashem sends Shmuel to anoint David. But Shaul is still the king, right? Shaul is the reigning king. He knows that he's not going to be the king anymore, but he is still the acting king. In the meanwhile, Shmuel like secretly anoints David as king. Without knowing this, Shaul gets a ruach ra me'eis Hashem. Hashem's like nevuah and spirit of kingship leaves him, and he becomes like this sort of somewhat like depressed, somewhat neurotic character for the rest of his life. And he needs someone to comfort him, and he calls David. Unbeknownst that David has been anointed king. Okay, and that kind of starts their relationship. Yonasan falls in love with David. Michal, the daughter of Shaul, falls in love with David. The nation falls in love with David. We have David fighting Goliath, after which everyone sings praises and says, ah, Shaul fought thousands of Plishtim, but David fought tens of thousands of Plishtim. And that creates a massive amount of jealousy in Shaul. And that's when he turns on David and continues to try to kill him for the rest of his life. So you have until Shaul dies, which is like a few prekim after the one that we're going to read, Shaul is continuously hunting David. And David is continuously running away. So everyone who David fights, he is victorious over, hands down. He is successful in all of his fights or whatever. He refuses to fight back Shaul. And instead, he just runs away. So that's the context that we have here. So again, there's a bunch of like back and forth and David running away and whatever. And we get to this point, which is that David is in Ein Gedi, which is super cool. How many of you guys went like on hikes in Ein Gedi? Do you remember that? Like, that was the Ein Gedi that David and his men, he had around 400 men, that David was hiding with. And Shaul decides to come and attack David. So he comes again. This is Shmuel Aleph, Perek Chaf Dalet, for those of you who want to follow along or read in the English or read in the Hebrew. And Shaul comes with 3,000 of his men and comes to fight and basically try to capture and kill David. Okay, David's hiding in Ein Gedi. And Shaul is coming with his marching army to Ein Gedi, where he's been told that David is, where he is, and is going to try to find David. And David and his men find this grand old hiding place called a cave. It was like some sort of huge cave, and David and his men are like all the way in the back in the dark. And Shaul walks in to the mouth of the cave. Okay, and that's like the drama point. Right? Because why? That's the point of tension. Because what's up for grabs now?
Kill each other.
What'd you say? David could kill him, but also, like, what are you assuming when you're saying David could kill him?
He can't kill David.
So again, the point here is who's going to notice the other one first, right? David and his men notice Shaul coming in, but if Shaul notices David and his men, they're dead.
It's like dark in the cave. Isn't it more likely they're going to see Shaul first?
No, okay, so it is, meaning that's what happens. So we think that that's like muvan me'alav. Then of course it had to happen that way, right? But Shaul and his men are terrified for that, those few seconds. Where Shaul, again, you can imagine it. They're in the cave, they could see Shaul. They could see the mouth of the cave, and they see Shaul coming in. If Shaul sees a glint of anybody's sword, if Shaul sees any shadows moving in the back of the cave, right, then he has 3,000 men, and David and his men are completely trapped in this cave. Right, so there's this moment where David and his men see Shaul, and they're not sure if Shaul sees them. And if he does, again, they're goners. So again, like Bat-Sheva said, it doesn't last for so long. That whole tension lasts for one pasuk. And then David realizes that, oh, Shaul does not see me. Shaul actually come into the cave to like use the bathroom, which is like a funny anachronistic way of saying it, because a bathroom is a room and it was a cave, right? But we all know what that means. He comes in to use the bathroom, so to speak, and David and his men chop that Shaul doesn't see them. And so what happens? David gets massively pressured by his troops to kill Shaul. Hi, David. He's hunting you. He has continuously hunted you. We're all running away with you, and he is completely at your mercy. And you've been anointed by Shmuel. You have a right to the kingship. So what they say, again, this is like incredible. This happens again and again and again in Sefer Shmuel vis-a-vis David. It just like shocked me when I actually read all the psukim. I had just done this for like for the 929 Nachyomi. Is that everybody's always like reading signs. Like when people come to tell Shaul where David is, he's like, Baruch atah Hashem. Hashem has blessed you. Like, thank you for being a messenger of Hashem to tell me where David is. He sees what's happening to him as like a sign from Hashem. And David's soldiers say to David, this is a sign from Hashem. Hashem has given Shaul over to your hands. This is amazing. Look at the Hashkocha here. He walked into the cave. Go kill him. This is the best thing Hashem could have done for you. Say thank you and go kill Shaul. And David absolutely refuses. Right? Since Rav Hirsch translates it, is that he sunders them with words. He basically just like keeps talking at them to stop them from hurting Shaul, and he refuses to hurt Shaul. And what he does instead is he goes and he cuts off, right, a little piece of Shaul's robe. When Shaul is standing like right there, so he sneaks around, again, you can imagine the tension there too, right? He sneaks around and he cuts off a piece of Shaul's robe. Shaul leaves the cave, and David, after, and he like goes down the hill, and David comes out afterwards and calls after Shaul and says, Shaul. And Shaul turns around and he says, I don't understand why you're trying to kill me. Because look, you walked into my cave. My men told me to kill you and I refused because I'm not trying to kill you. I don't mean you any harm. Look, I cut off a piece of your robe. That's how close I was to you. You know that I'm the most powerful soldier in all of Eretz Yisrael. Like, I wasn't scared of you, but I'm not trying to hurt you. I told them, like, chas v'shalom, that any of us should touch the Mashiach Hashem. David repeatedly calls Shaul Mashiach Hashem. I don't know if in Sefer Shmuel, meaning in Tanakh, I don't think David is called a Mashiach Hashem. David calls Shaul the Mashiach Hashem. He says, you were anointed. You were anointed by Shmuel. I'm not going to touch you. But why are you chasing after me? And then he says, like, you're chasing after a dead dog and like one flea. He's like, I'm not a threat to you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to take over your malchus. Go away. Like, I am not going to hurt you. And Shaul starts weeping. He says, David calls Shaul his father, and Shaul calls David his son. He says, Hakolcha b'ni David, right? One second. Just like, Hakolcha zeh b'ni David? Is that your voice, David? And he starts to, like, weep. And he says, like, I can see that you're more righteous than me, and you're a better man than me. And who does that? Who finds their enemy and then just, like, sends them away? Now I know that you're going to reign instead of me because you're a better man. And just please, when you do, don't wipe out my descendants. And David says, like, okay, of course not, right? His, like, best friend is Yonasan, and he's married to Shaul's daughter, Michal. So I don't think that was, like, ever going to be in David's plan anyways, right? But he says, okay, don't worry. And Shaul goes home. And again, like, you kind of hope and expect when you're reading it, like, that's going to be the end of, like, the Shaul chasing David story. And then Shaul will just, like, die in his old age peacefully and, like, that'll be that. But he doesn't. He continues to chase David, and David has a very similar encounter where he could have killed Shaul again and doesn't again. And then after that, Shaul is attacked by the Plishtim and is killed on the battlefield. And that's when David is finally stops fleeing from Shaul. So that's the historical context behind this, right? So again, when you read now the first pasuk of our perek, it's a very chilling time in David's life. Again, it was probably one of, if not the scariest time in David's life, because you could say the second time around, firstly, he wasn't cornered. Again, you could read that. And secondly, like, it had already happened to him that he had known that in a one-off with Shaul, he was going to have the upper hand, let's say. But anyways, right? It says, Maskila David biyoso bam'ara tefila. This is the maskila that David said in the cave, when he was in that cave and Shaul was there. Okay, so again, it's like, it's a very, very tense moment. The other pasuk, which is interesting and important to point out, the other perek that deals with the same situation is Nin Zion, which starts like this. Tell me what you think the difference is. Lam netzech al tashkeis lo David michtam. So this is a maskil, and that's a bevarcho mipnei Avshalom b'ma'ara, but sorry, bevarcho mipnei Shaul b'ma'ara, when David was running away from Shaul and was in the cave. So they're both written at that time. One of them is a michtam, and one of them is a maskil. What do you think the difference might be between a michtam, like a letter, writing down, and a maskil, a from Lashon Seichel, like an enlightenment, so to speak? What's the different ways that we're going to have to read these prakim? We might do Nun Zion next time. I'm not sure. Again, you guys will give me feedback. Or we can move on to a different, more well-known. Say it again, Eliana.
Can you re-explain what maskil is?
Good, I didn't explain it. I want you guys to say. Like, the word maskil means, from Milashon Seichel, like an enlightenment. Rav Hirsch translates it as a maskil. Sorry, the translator who's translating Rav Hirsch translated it. No, just kidding. Instruction. Right, instruction. That's what Rehersh translates it as, instruction. A maskil. Something to make someone else wiser, right? An enlightenment. Versus a michtam is a letter. What might be the difference between those two things?
If I'm understanding what they are, then when you write something down, it's post-processing.
Good.
As opposed to an instruction is not.
Interesting. Okay, actually, Rehersh, the way that Rehersh translates this, we're doing mostly Rehersh with a few pashtunim. The way that Rehersh says it is actually the opposite. That the michtam was the literal David writing down, like journaling, basically, right? Meaning, this is what happened to me, and this is what I was thinking at the time. Like, oh my God, then Shaul came into the cave, and this is what I was thinking, and da-da-da. So Nun Zion, which we're not doing today, is the michtam. It's like the literal writing of David when he was in the midst of it. Like, his recording of his experience of it. The maskil is the instruction, which again, Rehersh says, that part is filtered through David's like wisdom and perspective and is given to us like for future generations to learn from. Right? So one of them would be like, if I was writing a michtam, it would be like my journal. You're reading my journal about like this experience that I had. And a maskil would be like, I'm giving a class about that experience I had and what I learned from it so that you could learn from it. Versus like you're just reading my letter. So this one, Kufman Beis, he says it's a maskil, Rehersh again. Rehersh says, like, this is a maskil. This is David's instruction of, like, what David took out of this experience that he wants us to learn. What David did from this that was maskil, that he's going to use as an enlightenment, he's going to use as an instruction and give over. Again, as a tefillah. David writes Kufman Beis as an instructional tefillah. This is how we should learn and what we should learn from David's experience and use as one of our own prayers. So again, there's a lot of power here. So the way that Rehersh, like, this is really interesting in Rehersh's introduction to Tehillim. Rehersh apparently like loved Tehillim, and only at the end of his life, I think it was the last sefer he ever wrote, was his parish on Tehillim. So from the time that he was a boy, he used to learn it all the time, but only ever wrote a parish later. So he says in his introduction, which I thought was like totally fascinating, that one of his goal, like the way that he read Tehillim was this. He would read the Perek and then he would like think really hard and try to get into like the internal emotional and psychological world of David of why he said what he said. And basically try to distill it out to like, what's the main point, right? What's the main message that David is trying to tell me? And then how do I see that in the psukim that he writes? So every time I learned Tehillim in the past, which is like not meaning that everybody teaches like this, but every time I happen to have learned it with whoever I learned it, Tehillim always seems like a bunch of scattered psukim that like all have meanings and might all have like this some mystical significance, but like I didn't really understand what the Perek was trying to tell me. Right? And our approach is like, no, that's backwards. Like, that's what you have to do. You have to look at the psukim, look at the Perek and say, like, what's the message here? What is it trying to tell me as its base point that then I take away from this Perek? Okay? So think about that. We're going to go through the Perek. We're going to read the whole thing. Again, you guys will give me feedback about this, but like, let's read the whole thing once with the Hebrew and the English. Again, if you have it in front of you, it'll be a lot easier to just like chop and visualize for yourself. And then we're going to go through and talk again, just a second round, a little bit of like the meaning that different pashtunim give behind these psukim. And then we're going to talk about like, what's the essential meaning that again, David is trying to give us over as a maskil. Good. Good. So let's go. Maskil David b'yaso b'ma'ara sefila. A maskil, an instruction from David when he was in the cave. Tefila, as a prayer. Kuli el Hashem azak, my voice cries out to Hashem. Kuli el Hashem aschanan, my voice begs Hashem. Eshboch levonav sichi, I will pour out my my conversation before Hashem. Tzarasi levonav agid, I will tell him all of my woes. When my spirit is wrapped up inside of me, and you know the paths that I've taken, and all the paths that I've tread, they've set a snare for me. They've set like traps for me. I look to my right and I don't. I look to my right and I don't have anybody who recognizes me. Escape has been lost from me. Ein doresh lanafshi. Nobody is seeking my soul. Za'akti elecha Hashem. I cry out to you, Hashem. Amarti atamachsi. And I say to you, you are my protection. Chelki be'aretz hachayim. My portion in the land of the living. Hakshiva el rinasi kidalosi me'od. Please listen to my outpouring, because I'm very low. Hatzilini me'yirfai, save me from those who pursue me, ki amtu mimeni, because they're stronger than I am. Hotzia mimaskir nafshi lehodos hashemecha, take me out from this prison that my soul is in to praise your name. Biyachtiru tzadikim, through me righteous people will be crowned. Ki sigmol alai, because you have given me what I've deserved. Okay, so again, Tehillim, as we see, is usually extremely esoteric, right? It's poetry, it's song, it's prayer. It's like, it's very hard to understand off the bat without learning it a little bit more in depth. So again, let's try to go. I'm going to, again, just bring in Pashtanim. I'm going to try to do it with a little bit of a question and answer as we go through it. Okay, first pasuk we dealt with already. Koli el Hashem Azak, Koli el Hashem Eschanan. What's the repetition? Like, what's confusing about this pasuk? I guess I kind of gave that one away.
It uses two different lashonos of tefillah.
Good. It's kind of repetitive, right? Koli el Hashem Azak. Two different lashonos of tefillah, or two different, like, seemingly extremely parallel phrases, right? Why not just one? That you always have to ask, right? Koli el Hashem Azak. My voice is crying out to Hashem. Koli el Hashem Eschanan. My voice is praying to Hashem. So again, I don't know if anybody actually goes into, like, why Ezak, why Eschanan. I'm sure somebody does. Most of the Pashtanim in Rav Hirsch also, like, people, not only Pashtanim, but also who are trying to get the essence of it, aren't so meticulous about the details, probably because then you lose the poetry piece of it, which I think is like a little bit of also the taina that I have against how sometimes it's taught or was taught to me, that I kind of missed the whole thing. I don't have to complain about that right now. We can do that later. Okay, Rav Hirsch quotes a fascinating medrash, which says this. The reason that there's a double lashon, the medrash says this, Kuli el Hashem Azak, I cry out to Hashem because... Shelo epol biado. That, why, that what? That I don't fall into the hands of Shaul. Koli el Hashem Eschanan. But I cry out to Hashem in a different way. That what? What's he going to say next? What's the manager going to say? What's the flip side of that? Shelo yipol biado. What'd you say?
That I don't have to kill him.
Exactly. That he doesn't fall into my hands. Incredible, right? I'm davening to you that please, please, Hashem, don't let Shaul see me. And please, Hashem, don't let anybody here, including myself, harm Shaul. Right? So it's a double lashon of, like, David being like, not this, not that. Catch 22. Like, he is, what's the word for that? What would you say? Good. We'll fill it in later. Think about that. Okay, chapter 3, verse 3. Eshbuch lefanav sichi, I pour out before him my conversation, sarasi lefanav agid, and I tell him all of my tzaros, all of my pain. What's the extra word here that might point to the meaning behind this pasuk? What's extra here?
Sichi.
Or what's emphasized here? What'd you say?
Sichi, like you don't need sichi and sarasi.
And agid.
Okay, interesting, Chavi. What'd you say about Shava?
So you're saying what's redundant?
Yeah, what's redundant?
Lefanav.
Good. Lefanav is mentioned twice, right? Eshpoch lefanav sichi, tzarasi lefanav agid. And again, Rav Hirsch says that you see that from that stress. Again, eshpoch sichi, I'm going to pour out how I feel. Tzarasi agid, I'm going to tell him what I'm upset about. And you could have said lefanav in either of those two, but it's eshpoch lefanav sichi, tzarasi lefanav agid. Right? It's David is making very salient who it is that he's talking to. He's making it salient to us, he's making it salient to himself. He's talking to Hashem. That's for sure. Bizatev olai ruchi, when, this is interesting what Rav Hirsch is like, touch on this. Bizatev, so Bizatev is a difficult word. It actually means to like wrap something in something else. So one of the Pashtanim, I think it was Radak, says that Bizatev olai nafshi is a way of saying like, my soul was wrapped up inside of me as if like his soul was in like a fetal position, just like out of like trauma and pain, right? That he is like totally just like, again, it's poetry, right? He's inside of me, my soul was like in this fetal position out of like massive stress and trauma and difficulty. And then it's like a weird thing, right? But they're not related. And Rehersh says like, David was going on one track and sort of interrupts himself. Okay, so he's like starting a sentence, dot, dot, dot. And then you see, he's like, he like has to go into a different track. And what is that track? You know the paths that I've taken. In these paths that I've taken, they've set a snare for me. What emotion do you hear behind that piece? He's a tankful Irochli is like him in the same vein as like Tsarasi, Lefanav, Agid, right? Like he's upset. He's describing how much emotional pain he's in. But then he like interrupts himself to tell you like why? Why? What is he feeling?
Like trusting Hashem.
Good. I'm not sure if it's trusting Hashem yet, right? I mean, that definitely is like one of the overarching themes here. But like, what is he?
The anger.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like a certain indignation, right? And he's not angry at Hashem, right? He's indignant. It's like I tell you that, Tennessee, but so you know, like how I work, you know how I function. Wherever I go, they're setting traps for me. And like, I don't want to do anything. I'm not trying to hurt anybody. Right? You know my paths. You know that I'm not plotting or setting a path to hurt anybody, but everywhere I go, they're all trying to trap me. And again, David was like turned in, he keeps being turned into Shaul by people who like owe him good. That's another like theme of David. It's like he does favors for people or just like he's on the same side as people and then they go and like rat him out to Shaul. So he feels like Shaul's chasing him for no reason. The people who are ratting him out to Shaul are ratting him out for no reason. Like David doesn't deserve any of this. All right, and that's why you hear this certain indignation. Habet Yamin Urei, right? I look to my right. What is it? What's this symbolize as I look to my right? Like, what does that mean? Why doesn't he look for his left? What does he expect? I mean, what does it mean if you look to your right and nobody's there?
Strength.
Okay, he's saying not only strength, but like, let's say I was saying like...
Dependability?
What did you say?
Dependability.
Dependability of what?
That people won't turn on you.
Good, right. He's saying, Habet Yamin Urei Ve'ili Makir. Meaning there's a Havamina that there should be a Makir, right? He's saying, I look to my right and where I'd expect to see allies, right? On my right hand coming up, like Javi is saying, in this position of strength, there's nobody there. Anyone who I would think to be my ally is totally not there. Avad Manos Mimeni, I have nowhere to escape. Right? Radak says that anywhere I think to go that I would be safe, somebody else rats me out and Shaul ends up there chasing me down. I can't go anywhere. Here I am in this cave and Shaul's in the entrance of the cave. Like, I have nowhere to go. Angel Reish Lanafshi, that there's nobody who is willing to fight my fight for me. That's again what Radak says. Angel Reish Lanafshi, right? There's nobody who is going to come and try to fight my fight for me because who's going to try to fight a fight against the king? If it's me against the king of Israel, and David obviously feels like this himself too, he keeps calling Shaul Mashiach Hashem. If it's me versus Shaul, I can't. Nobody can. Nobody could fight. Justly, nobody could fight my fight against Shaul. He's the king. So I'm done for. Sforno says, which is interesting, in Do Reish Lanafshi, there's nobody who's petitioning for my soul. He's saying, like, nobody's even davening for me. Like, that's what he's coming from. He's like, in Do Reish Lanafshi, nobody's like trying to like hope that I do okay. It's painful, right? You hear David's emotions here. I cry out to you, Hashem. I say, you are the one who's going to be my refuge, my portion in the Eretz Achayim. That not only do I like look to you for Olam Haba, but I also realize that like the only thing I have in Olam Haza, again, I'm always being chased down. I'm always running away. The only thing I have is like you, both to ensure my life. And like, this is the only thing that's stable for me, is my connection with you. Everything else is like, this is my only actual portion in this world. Like, I thought I was going to be the king. That I have a palace. I thought I would have like at least like the brothers and the cattle and whatever else that like normal shepherds have, but like no. Chelki bar zachaim. The only thing, my only chelak here really seems to be you, Hashem. Hakshiva el renesi kedelosi mod hatzlein mirat faykiyim to mimeni. No one really comments on that pasuk for some reason. Hotziyami masgir nafshi lohodas Hashemecha. Take me out of the prison of my soul to praise your name. Biachtir tzadikim. Through me, tzadikim will be crowned. When people see that you have saved me, David is saying, then the righteous will all feel like a massive amount of basically like validation in some capacity through that. They'll say, look, here's David. And he, like Eliana was saying, and he was a ma'amin b'Hashem and he trusted that Hashem would save him and Hashem saved him. So like we have again, this like sort of crown of contentment, of like security, that now we feel like this is how Hashem works. This is what's going to happen to us. Also, kizig molai, when you save me. So if you had to, again, go back to that parak, what pasuk would you say is the turning point? It basically follows pretty steadily, I would say, a theme until there's one pasuk that changes it. What would you say that pasuk is? And again, that's going to be the clincher.
say the question again?
Yes. If you look at the perek, you will see, I think, that it seems to follow like a relatively stable thread of what David's coming from and the kind of emotions that he's describing. And then it kind of switches. So at what point does it switch that we're going to have to look deeper at that pasuk? What do you think?
Zakti.
Good. Why?
Because that's when he does something about it. Like before it's talking about, it's like, I think it's setting you up to understand what he's going through. And then he calls out to Hashem. Like there's an action.
Good. Okay. I'm really happy that you said that because like, that's exactly what I want to talk about. But I don't think that that's not where we're going to go. But it's really important that you said that. So who agrees or disagrees with Bathsheba? Carrie?
I agree.
Okay, you agree? Does anyone disagree with Bathsheba? Because Rav Hirsch does. Does anyone chop what Rav Hirsch is going to say? What's his turning point, basically?
When he says that there's nobody next to him?
When there's nobody next to him? What was someone else started talking to? Was it Dina Brecha?
It was okay. Me. I was saying what Bathsheba said makes sense. At least the reason to me is because that's when he turns from like, he's like crying out to Hashem and he's like expressing like everything he's feeling. And that's the point where he turns to Hashem.
Okay, good. So let's talk about that. Rav Hirsch says that the turning point is, I mean, he doesn't use it in that exactly that way, but that's how I'm reading Rav Hirsch, let's say, in his parish, the first and last pieces of Rav Hirsch's parish, if you want to read it and be machalik on me, I'm happy for you to do that, is the last pasuk. Okay? To me, and you'll see it, like, let me read it again, but the last pasuk seems to, like, take a totally different approach than the previous two pasukim, and I explained it very badly, and in that way I kind of cheated, because I didn't want to get totally into it. So... But it's very weird, right? David is going on and saying, I'm calling out to you. Don't, again, like, what's the basic sentiment of the first at least three psukim? What would you say David feels blank? Fill in the blank. David feels what? What is he expressing? David feels, Sarah Fuchs offered angry for at least one of those psukim. Eliana offered emuna, which is gishmak, but I don't know if you see it so much. Meaning, for sure, you see that, but yeah, bracha.
He feels alone.
He feels alone. Good. What's a similar kind of word?
Helpless.
Helpless. Abandoned. Good. Dependent. Okay. Abandoned. What more?
Depression.
Depressed. Okay. Upset. Angry. Come on.
I feel like hopeless.
Hopeless. Let me read it this way. I'm crying out to you, Hashem. Don't let Shaul find me, and don't let me find Shaul. I'm pouring out my conversation before you. I'm telling you everything that's wrong. Again, I'm in this like fetal position inside myself, and you know the pounds that I've taken, and everywhere I go, they're waiting there with their snare. What'd you say?
It's understood.
Oh, is he making his case?
Making his
frustrated.
Case?
Frustrated?
I think he feels trapped.
Yeah.
No? Meaning, I also think he feels dependent. I also think he feels, you know, angry and indignant. But I think the main thing, and again, I don't know, it seems to me like the main expression that he's saying is like he's completely trapped. And he literally is trapped at the time. He's in a cave, and if Shaul sees him, he's trapped, and he's going to get killed by Shaul's army of 3,000 people. So again, and I think you see it from the first medrash, on the first pasuk, basically, the second pasuk, which is like, don't let him kill me, but don't let me kill him. So what? Right? David's in this like very, very tight space, very tight space. Don't let him see me, but don't let my men kill him. And then, again, I'm going to, and then his crying, this is where I'm machalik on Bathsheba and Carrie, which I think is like a good, I think the way that you're reading it is good, and that's what we'd expect, and that's why, that's what we learned from the last pasuk as the turning point, is that his tefillah is not a resolution of this, right? His tefillah, his resolution is not, I feel trapped, so I'm going to daven to Hashem. That I don't think is the message that you see behind this perek, because he davens to Hashem in the beginning. His tefillah is part of what he's upset about, right? It's part of his emotional experience in this perek is the tefillah. Right away, he's crying out to Hashem. Again, don't let him kill me, don't let me kill him. But like, He's crying out to Hashem. I'm going to tell you all my tzaros, Hashem, right? I'm in such pain. Everywhere I go, they're trying to trap me. I don't mean evil to any of these people, and they're all trying to chase me down. They won't leave me alone. I look to my right. I expect to have allies. Nobody's there for me. Nobody even cares about me, and nobody could fight this fight for me against the king, and I know that because he's the king, and I think that he's the king, and that's why I'm not killing him. Right? Like, he's told, Zahati lech Hashem, amarti yatamachsi. I say to Hashem, like, you are it. You're the only one. So again, Zahati lech Hashem, I don't think is the resolution. Like, he's feeling so upset, so he says, oh, Hashem, you're my chalek in Eretz Chaim. I don't think so. I think it's a continuation, because you see, it's not the first time. Kohiel Hashem azak. He cries out to Hashem before, and then Zahati lech Hashem, amarti, right? And he's just crying out again. It's part of his whole emotional experience, not the resolution of his emotional experience. It's not, I'm feeling trapped, so I'm calling out to Hashem. It's like, Hashem, I'm crying because I'm feeling trapped, and I'm crying because I feel trapped. Because I tell Machsi, you're the only thing I have. No, I have no allies. I have no one who's fighting for me. I have nowhere that's safe for me. I'm calling Hashem, you're my only refuge, and you're my only chalek. Right? I don't think that's a resolution. I think that that's a continuation of the emotions that he's expressing. Is he's like, he's totally trapped, and he's totally dependent. Hakshiv Al Rinasi, right? He says, like, please listen to me. Hatsilina Merit fight came to me many. Again, they're bigger than me. If Chol sees me in a split second, if he sees a glint of anybody's sword, if anybody sneezes, we're done. We're all done. My entire army, we're all about to get wiped out. And then there's like a weird pasuk. Pasuk says, Hotsiyami Maskar Nafshi, take me out of this prison that I'm trapped in, out of the prison of my soul. Lahodo Sishamecha, to praise your name. Biach Tiru Tzadikim, Tzadikim will crown themselves with me. Ki Sigmo alive when you save me. It's like a weird pasuk, right? So again, that I think is the outlier pasuk. You're just like, meaning most of you, I think, probably skimmed over it because I skimmed over it because that's where I was going, is to talk about it a little bit more, right? But that seems to switch. And what's the major switch there? Is that David is now not only, sorry, I'm just like trying to be cognizant of time, so I'm like going a little bit faster, is that David is now not only talking about his emotional experience, but now he just did what? He just switched hashkafos. Right? He switched the perspective of his own life. What did he just do?
He brought other people into it.
Good. He brought other people into it. In what way?
Giving that as a reason for him to save him.
Good. Right? He that seems to be the resolution of his emotional experience is, Hashem, what I want you to do is save me. Not because I have emunah, and because I'm dependent on you, and because I have nowhere else to go, so like, please, 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 please just save me. Right? But he sort of takes a step up. And he says, you saving me is going to have significance. I'm going to appreciate it, that I'm not trapped anymore. But I want you to do it, or I'm asking you to do it, not just so that I get saved, but so that what? Then it has some sort of message. I'm going to praise your name so that tzadikim, people who are like me. People who are in the same position as me. They're these like righteously indignant people. They're these righteous people who are just trying to do what's right. Right? Again, like, and they're trapped. And they're feeling stuck. And they're feeling like nothing's helping them. And they're feeling like they have nowhere to go. And they're going to see that, listen, I was too. I was just a good guy trying to do what's right. I refuse to kill Shaul. I refuse to read messages into things and do things that are not allowed, like killing the Mashiach of Hashem. Even though my men were bantering, like were pestering me about it, and even though it's such a great opportunity, even though I still feel trapped because I didn't kill Shaul, and he's going to keep chasing him, and he does. He keeps chasing David. David was right about it. But I'm refusing to do something that I don't think is my right to do.
Anna, what does the last part of that pasuk literally mean?
So Yachtir, the source of that is a keter. So it means through me tzadikim will be crowned.
So how is that saying what you're saying? Unless you're saying like someone else's shot on it.
I mean, well, I'm not saying my own shot. I'm saying both Radak Rashi and Rav Hirsch. So let me tell you, Radak says specifically, Biachtir Tzadikim. One second, let me just look up which one was Radak and which was Rashi so I don't get them confused. Hold on a second. Good. So Radak says, okay, Biachtir Tzadikim, Kisigmolai. Again, they're difficult words. Again, Yachtiru, using keter, which is a crown, as a verb, right? It's poetic word, so it's hard to like get the literal grasp of it. But biach tir tzadikim, through me tzadikim will be crowned. ki sigamul alai, when you give a gomel is something that was owed to somebody, usually a reward. It's usually like a positive phrase of giving something what they deserve. So when you give me the reward or when you give me what I deserve in a good way, then tzaddikim will be crowned through me. So again, it's like, what is that? What does David HaMelech mean, right? That's what everyone's going to have to say. So Radak says, yeah, when it's obvious that only Hashem saved me, when it's obvious that I was totally trapped, I was totally stuck, and that Hashem saved me, then tzaddikim will say, oh, it's because David trusted in Hashem, and Hashem saves those who trust in him. Similar to what Eliana said, right? Rashi said something similar, that they will crown Hashem, bi'achtiru tzaddikim. Through me, tzaddikim will yachtiru somebody else. Through me, tzaddikim will yachtiru, will give a crown to Hashem. Because very similar, they'll say, Hashem is totally reliable to repay tzaddikim. Okay, so like again, they'll feel in some way, I don't use the word like validated. It's not about crowning anybody, because like that's an idiom. Right? But it seems to me like the idiom is like you feel validated, you feel justified, you feel encouraged by seeing something. Maybe encouraged is a better word. Right? You feel encouraged by having witnessed something else.
Hanukkah, I see a question.
Yeah, hold on. Let me just tell Rav Hirsch's shop shot, and then I want your question, okay? Right, so Rav Hirsch takes this, again, I'm being like a little Hirschian in how I'm explaining it more. Rav Hirsch takes it more as like a duty piece. He says that again and again, in the first and the second. Right, the world will then know that nothing is more potent than a life and conduct centered around the endeavor to do one's duty faithfully. Right, they'll see that all I tried to do was what was right. All I tried to do was my duty and not overstep that, not try to kill Mashiach Hashem, not try to wage an own war and do this rebellion against Shaul because I've been anointed and he's been anointed. All I tried to do was like what I thought was right. And when people see, and it will be such a message to the world to see what he calls, quote unquote, persecuted innocence. That when they see that it will convince all the rest of the world of the victorious power inherent in persecuted innocence. Right? That if you just try to do what's right, even if you're persecuted, even if your life looks harsh afterwards, that in the end, you're the one who's going to come out on top, right? And again, Rav Hirsch is saying, basically, that message, and again, I think it works very well with Radak and Rashi, right? That this, the point of the last pasuk is that it switches the message. David is saying, save me for this global message. What the exact pshat of the global message is, Radak, Rashi, and Rav Hirsch, are different from each other very slightly, right? But they're all saying this global message. I want you to save me so that tzaddikim learn something, so that people who are doing what's right, like me, will learn something about how you, Hashem, act. People who have emunah, people will say, look, Hashem saved David because he has emunah, and we have emunah too. Hashem is going to save us. People who, right, are worried about whether or not Hashem is reliably going to repay them will say, look, David was a tzaddik, and Hashem reliably repaid him. And I've heard people who are just trying to do what's right and feel like for some reason it's not working out, we'll be able to say, look at the value, it's like, right? The victorious power inherent in persecuted innocence. David was good. David was doing what was right. And in the end, he came out on top. And so David is saying, let what happens to me be a message. I want you to save me so that it's a message for everybody else who's in a similar situation to me. Sarah Fuchs. E. Fuchs.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So here's my thought. I'm curious what your thought on this is. While I'm reading through this, like a lot of this reminds me of kind of Hannah in some sense of like this way of davening and way of saying like Hashem, give me something so that I give it back to you. And like you kind of see that in both like David and Hannah, I guess, like in the way that they daven. Unless I like took that. Do you think that there's something we could take from that to like apply to our lives in terms of like finding that way of like asking Hashem for something, but like flipping it to return it back to him?
Good, awesome. So again, I think I love that. That's also Rav Lichter's like whole mahalach on tefillah. And again, I think to me like that was the resounding point, right? If we're looking at this and we're trying to distill out what's the point that we learn from this perek, and again, what is some of the kavana that we could have while we're saying this perek, right? It's not just the dependence, right? But it definitely is the emotionality, which again, Sarah, when me and you were learning Chana, she definitely has that too, right? Is the really stinging emotion that she has behind everything that she says, right? He's feeling, he's crying out to Hashem, he's in pain, he's ate v'lai nafshi, his soul's like in a fetal position, right? He's feeling upset and indignant. And again, then he says, but he's able to see himself and his own life from a higher vantage point. And he's able to ask for something from that higher vantage point. Don't just save me, so to speak, because I have trust in emunah in you and I'm dependent on you, which is all true, but also save me because I want to teach the world something about your name. I want to be significant beyond myself, not in a selfish way, but in like a, I want people to learn about you from what happens to me. So if I'm in this cave and everyone knows and there's that tension point, I want it to be that I'm saved, not just for my own merit and my own sake, but I want to be saved so that people learn about you, right? It's like, it's a much higher way of looking at ourselves. Okay, I'm going to pause the recording now and then questions and discussion.